Gabriel Fuentes' debut novel, The Sleeping World, arrives on shelves today and transports us to a difficult time in Spanish history. It's 1977. Spain is transitioning from the brutal Francisco Franco regime to an uncertain democracy. Elections are on the horizon and protests erupt throughout the country. The narrator, Mosca, searches for her missing brother. Though thought dead, she travels throughout Spain and France looking for any trace of him. She's accompanied by three fellow university students who are on their own journeys. Together, they try to be punk while also dealing with the trauma of Franco's regime. Gabriel Fuentes is pursuing a PhD at the University of Georgia. And while the events of this historical fiction do not match her own, her grief does. Like Mosca, she lost her brother. Producer Gabby Watt spoke with Gabriel Fuentes by Skype, starting with the connection between grief and punk.
I always loved The Clash and the Ramones, but I started listening more to punk music when I was researching this book. And I got really into Patti Smith. And I think there's something about a singer like her in which there's a quality of, you know, like the qualities of punk, right, that it's unrestrained, it's raw, it's a performance, but it's a performance that is as much for the musician as for the audience. And so I think that that kind of relates back to like older traditions of mourning and grief where you have things like the like keening practices and like wailing practices where people are performing their grief in this way that's really visible and really visceral. You know, the people who were involved in like the really DIY punk scene in Spain at the time were people who were facing really intense forms of oppression and had grown up under intense forms of oppression. A lot of the punk movement was very popular in regions that had seen a lot of negative control by Franco, regions where people were like in Catalan, they weren't allowed to speak their language. In the Basque region, again, not allowed to speak their language. And so there were often people who were really on the fringes of society, and the punk music was, there were people who were getting arrested, and people who were really living outside of like what we consider a safe life. I mean, there's a sense when I was doing research that these people were in a real place of danger and had grown up facing hunger, facing their family members being murdered. So that sense of anger that you hear in the music is coming from that place.
And in doing your research, were there specific people that you had stumbled across or read about who became the four main characters in the novel?
No, not at all, really. The characters in the novel are totally my creations, or kind of they came to me, not from history, but more from personal experience. Mosca is in a way very close to me, but La Canaria, her friend and kind of a friend, rival, enemy, is also very close to me.
Well, it's interesting that you said friend, because in the book they are completely opposed to using the word friend. And also, I mean, it's interesting how, you know, they go on this epic journey together, yet at the same time there's so much distance between them, even while they're, you know, so physically close to each other and having this these experiences that are so intertwined with each other.
Yeah, I think, and it's interesting because in some ways it's hard to talk about the book because a lot of it is about not talking about things, like not naming things, not using words that display emotion or that could be seen as being part of like the former regime. From the outside, one might consider them friends, even though they end up doing really terrible things to each other, but they never call themselves that. And I think in a lot of ways, they're all on this sort of separate journey that they need each other in order to keep the motor of the journey moving. But they try not to rely on each other emotionally. And I think especially for Mosca, the narrator, there's a fear that becoming attached emotionally is going to in some way result in the loss of someone because she's lost so many people that she cares about.
The book itself, it's packed with trauma. And it almost seems that this distance that they carry is necessary for their survival, because if they get too close to that pain, they wouldn't be able to go on.
Yeah, and so it's a survival mechanism, and I think it also becomes like this choice that demonstrates their desire to be separate from the past and to kind of, you know, break with the past, break with the old regime, and the idea of like sincerity or emotional connection. They see that as like ploys that are used to oppress and control people. And so this sort of survival technique of you can't care too much becomes also like almost like an aesthetic or choice to stay removed. And that's like a part of who they are.
I can't imagine the terror and, again, the trauma, as I said before, that people in Spain must have been feeling at the time, because not only, you know, is there this absence of names, but there's also an absence of bodies. And you say several times throughout the book, you know, instead of receiving the body of a disappeared family member or loved one, you know, someone who supposedly has passed away, you just receive their medallions. And it seems without, you know, having the physical body of the dead, there is such a lack of closure. Through doing your own research, do you think that Spain has found closure from that time period? And how is this time period remembered in Spain?
So right now is a time when people have started to look back into the Civil War and the time during Franco's regime, because it's now no longer illegal to like excavate graves and find who's buried there. For a long time, it was illegal to investigate any crimes of the Civil War or the regime. But there's been like a formal declaration of the government condemning the Franco regime. And so, you know, it's limited what can be done. And a lot of the people who are guilty of these crimes are dead, because some of it happened so long ago. I think it's, when I was there in 2007, which was just when these laws were being overturned, and people didn't talk about it very much. It felt to me, I mean, I was only a visitor there, but it felt to me like a big wound that people tried to keep covered as much as possible. And I think in the town where I was living in Salamanca, which is a, you know, kind of small university town, I felt a really intense tension between the older generation who had lived under Franco, some of whom had been fascists or supported the regime in some way. I heard people say, oh, he wasn't that bad, from the older generation. And then the younger generation were much more like the characters, the young people in my book. You know, I met a lot of people who considered themselves anarchists or, you know, at the least socialists, and who were really, you know, considered Franco and his regime a form of almost Nazism. But they still, it didn't feel like those groups were talking very much. But I think that honestly, it's one of those questions that it's hard to generalize, because I think everyone has their own kind of personal way of working through those issues of the past. Some people don't want to talk about it. Some people really, you know, are like, let's figure out everybody who's missing. Let's find them. Let's find their graves. So I think it's a really complicated question.
At the end of the book, there's a pivotal cathartic moment under the water, and Mosca throughout the book starts seeing these shadows. She becomes more and more paranoid. You know, maybe it's madness. And I was wondering, through your own grief that you experienced with the loss of your brother, was sort of writing her through this narrative of magical realism, was that the only way for her to sort of end the search for her brother? And was that something that was reflected in your own grief as well?
I kind of shy away from the term magical realism, not because I love a lot of books that incorporate magical realism, and I'm really influenced by that. But I think that the sort of descent, like there are ghosts in the books, there are these kind of figures who are haunting her. At the time when I was writing the book, and even now, those things feel very real. I think when one is grieving, the sense of being haunted feels as real as anything else. So her hearing her brother's voice, her brother speaking and shaping the narrative, are things that felt really necessary to the story. And also that felt accurate to what grief is like. Because I think when, at least when I was grieving, there's a sense that one's notion of like what a narrative is and what's real, what's expected, just completely fades away, or not fades, it's, you know, violently ruptured. Death is kind of this like break in narrative that doesn't seem to make sense, even though obviously it's, you know, one of the giant rules of our existence. But especially when my brother, he was very young when he passed away. And so that kind of breaks one sense of narrative and one sense of what's real. And so I was writing this, it was also a way for me to grieve. And I wanted to do that in a way that's felt as honest as possible to what I was experiencing and what Mosca might have experienced.
Well, thank you so much for talking about The Sleeping World. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it.
Thank you so much. Jesus died for somebody.